Hi, welcome to Bipolar Bicoastal. I'm Anna.
And I'm Maria.
We're twins living on opposite coasts.
Here to talk about navigating life while bipolar.
Hi, Nanners. Welcome to Bipolar Bicoastal. How are you?
Hi, Mia. I'm so good. I am so excited because today we have very special guest, Rudy Caceres. Rudy, do you want to tell us, the listeners, a little bit about yourself?
Hey, everyone. My name is Rudy Caceres. I'm a bipolar mental health advocate. Been sharing my story since 2014. I was diagnosed in college with bipolar, but I actually had a major mental health breakdown when I was in the Army in 2009, and that kind of kickstarted my whole mental health journey to eventually being to a place where I can be a public speaker, I can write about my experience, make videos, and do live streams, and travel the country, and hopefully do that again soon. And so I just love talking about bipolar. Any platform, give it to me. So I'm really thankful that you reached out to me and given me this opportunity to share my story, because I haven't done it in quite a while. I'm used to interviewing people, so it's refreshing to be back on the other side again.
Well, we are just so honored because anyone who knows our podcast probably knows about you already. It's you're quite a superstar in the bipolar advocacy world. You've been sharing your story for so long and then hosting those monthly talks for the Mighty. And it's just such a privilege to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. The thing with the Mighty, it was a good timing, good place, because I was living in Los Angeles at the time. Mm-hmm. I actually moved to Colorado last summer, and they were based in Burbank, California. And so I met their editor for their mental health section at an event I was doing, and she wanted me to do a video about bipolar mania, and I did that. And then she was like, do you want to do live streams? And I was like, okay, but I want to come into the office, because like they had a cool setup and I wanted to.
Yeah, you're like, that sounds fun.
yeah. So I did that, and like I was kind of iffy about it. And then I decided, like, you know what, it'd be easier if like I just had someone with me. So I just started inviting people in to interview. And it just became this thing for every single month. I would interview someone in person, a mental health advocate, and we had some great times. And I actually got to interview Maria Bamford a couple of years ago, and I've gotten to interview other top leading mental health advocates, and it was a great journey. Yeah. But then the office closed down. Actually, my last interview there was last March. We're coming out, actually, I was like March like 12th or 15th. So it was
just about a year ago.
Right when I went home to in Los Angeles from the office as well. Not the Mighty, but like from my office too. Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting because obviously things were starting to shut down. That it actually a global pandemic had already been declared by the CDC in the United States, and so the my producer at the Mighty was like, do you really still want to come into the office tomorrow? And I was like, well, yeah, because like I wanted to do this interview with this person who had reached out to me, kind of similar how to you did. And I was like, well, if she's willing to come in and I want to make this work, because I know it's probably going to be the last one, at least for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I want to have a proper send off. And so we did that. And then everything closed down. The Mighty's office closed down. And then I moved out to Colorado. But I still wanted to do interviews and host shows and do other kinds of things. And live streaming, it was a case of the right time. Mm. It's weird to think of like silver linings amongst the pandemic.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And like I had done a lot of live streaming prior to that, but I really felt like before the pandemic and everything shut down, everything was virtual, live streaming was seen as kind of this niche. A lot of people didn't take it seriously, or it was just a fad, you know, like Snapchat and stuff like that. It was just like something that was like flash in the pan. And then like everyone's kind of just forced to live stream. And so I wanted to make sure I was at the forefront of that. And so that's why after a while of taking a break, I came back to the Mighty and started doing these panels, call them round rectangles, where I interview different bipolar mental health advocates about different topics. Mm-hmm. And you happen to stumble upon one of my panels that had Alan Forney on, who I know is one of your favorite people in the whole wide world.
Yes. So,
I have like two of her books in my bookcase behind me that no one listening to this can see. So,
It's a very awesome cool bookcase.
Yeah.
No one can see.
Multicolored. Yeah. And we also, Sarah Jickling was on The Mighty as well, and we interviewed on one of your panels, and we interviewed her too.
She's awesome.
She's so cool.
And great podcast voice because she's a singer. But so would you mind explaining to the audience what The Mighty is for people who might not be familiar with the publication?
Yes. And first and foremost, I want to make clear that I'm not an employee of The Mighty, but I have done work with them in the past and find ways to contribute, but I'm not on their payroll or anything like that. So this is not sponsored by The Mighty.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Imagine.
I know.
It could be.
but they're all cool people there. Like they're even like their CEO is like one of the coolest people in the world. So everyone there like really gets it. And a lot of them have like health conditions in some form. And so The Mighty, for those who don't know, first things first, it's a it's basically a website where people can submit their stories or opinion pieces based on topics relating to different health conditions. So they have all kinds of different verticals related to, say, cancer or to other chronic and rare illnesses. But one of the most popular one is their mental health section. And I remember when they first started, I think it was like 2014 or somewhere around that. But I was like, oh, that's cool. I want to work with them someday. But like, I'm not cool enough. That's basically what they do. It's basically they publish people's stories, and they also do like kind of like BuzzFeed and like lists and stuff like that. And in addition to that, they also do live streaming on their Facebook and YouTube channels and have different contributors. It's all contributor based. So all of their content is, for the most part, except for a very small staff, it's submitted from viewers and readers. And so that's how I got involved. And that is what The Mighty is. And they've got an app and other cool things. They're continuing to grow.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And just circling back a little bit, would you mind telling us, so you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder in college. Like, what kind of led up to that? Did you, like, was it like a manic episode, a depressive episode? Like, how did that all like kind of play out, and how did you end up getting your diagnosis at the end of it?
Ooh, that's a good question. This might take some time. So
yeah,
totally bad time. Nothing but time.
Okay, so I mean, I've always dealt with mental health issues my entire life. Just had like a really bad upbringing, dealt with a lot of bullying as a kid as well, and neglect, and just really low self-esteem issues. Lived in poverty, and so not fun times in a healthy adulthood that does not make. I always believed that I was meant for great things in life. And so I'm always trying to find ways to realize that potential. But I ran into a pit in my early 20s, and I wanted to do something with my life, but there was no opportunities. This was back in like 2008, and so like you had the financial collapse and couldn't find work. I was like my third year of community college, and was like in my mind I wanted to become an actor. So I was like taking like all these like theater classes and doing musicals, even though I can't sing or dance to save my life. but like I was like taking like no general ed classes. And the ones I would take, like, I would fail at them, and I would get, like, all A's in, like, all my acting classes. And so...
And you're like, can I just get a degree in just acting classes? Is that an option at this community college?
Seriously, if it was, like, I'd be, like summa cum laude, yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But the thing was, is that I had to find a quote-unquote real job. I'm doing air quotes on a podcast, which is always awesome. and so I decided to join the Army because, of course, that's what one does when you run out of options, I guess.
You have low options, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
That's what they're set up for, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah, and so like things kind of like just... snowballed from there, and in February of 2009 I joined the Army, and I went to basic training in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. First time ever being in snow, and it was the worst experience I've ever had in my life.
Yeah,
like I'm totally not cut out for the Army lifestyle. Like I've never been that type. I've never like even been athletic, and so it was a hard time, and like I was just bullied by everyone. Like the drill sergeants were like some of the nicest ones. It was like the other people. Yeah, it was really weird. Yeah. Like I actually was
probably hard to be like a theater major in the
nice,
Army.
mm-hmm. Nice drill sergeants. I actually got promoted because when you join and you have like a certain number of college credits, you automatically get promoted. So I went from the bottom rung is like E1, like private nothing. You don't even get like an insignia patch on you. And so like I went in there with like E3 private first class, and people were like, how did you like already become like a private first class? I was like, I have like 60 units of theater classes.
They're like, that's not the cool way in the army to get to private first class.
Yeah. So it was a bad experience all around. I tried to make the best of it, but like it was just like every day I felt like a failure. Just like from like
awful,
the smallest things. Like I rolled my ankle over twice in 1 week, like before we even actually started training.
Oh no.
Yeah. Like I remember requesting to see the chaplain like after the first week, and I'm not even like that religious, but like that was like the only way to get out of basic training hell, like being yelled at all the time and all that stuff. Like so yeah,
it's the only confidential one too, and that they wouldn't report anything to anyone, the chaplains.
Yeah, no, it was
yeah.
it's weird how that works. And like I remember even going to the Latter-day Saints church because I just had a friend. It was like my only friend that I met when I was in processing, and he was just a member of LDS. And so we went into different units when like we formally started basic training. And so like I had to see someone, so that was like my only like opportunity. So like I went to like I don't know if anyone's ever been to LDS churches, but like they like their services are like so long, and there's like multiple sections and stuff. It's like I'm raised Catholic, so it was like totally foreign to
God, and Catholic's long to start with anyways, so if that felt long to you, I like can't even imagine.
Oh
like,
yeah, and it's like it's
how long it was.
Condensed in basic training too, as you would imagine. But I made it through basic training just barely. Like I almost cracked towards the end. And my drill sergeant, though, like he said, like, just Caceres, because we call everyone by our last names, just get through this. This is not the real army. This is all just like just trying to like scare you and all that stuff and being hard asses. And so once you get onto your real unit, everything's going to be okay. And like, don't worry. And I was lucky to have like an actual like cool drill sergeant. So I made it through there. Like I didn't even invite anyone to my graduation because I didn't think I was going to graduate. And like I thought like, well, we're in the middle of the woods in Missouri. A bunch of people's families are going to come. I was the only one who graduated who did not have anyone come.
Oh. So depressing.
Yeah. But thankfully I made it through, and I went on to my military intelligence training, which sounds like a cool job. Like it's like military intelligence. You'd think like Mission Impossible type stuff, like hacking into computers and all that stuff. It was funny because like whenever we would get down and depressed and stuff, like our platoon sergeant would say like, you know, I know this all sucks right now, because like we would just do like a bunch of like PowerPoint and like mapping and symbols and stuff.
Right.
And it's really, really like tedious, slow, like slow computers. And like, I don't know if anyone has ever used GIS software, like geographical imaging software. It's just the worst. It's so not like as fancy as it sounds.
Yeah.
But he would say like, well, all that stuff you see in the movies, that stuff's all real, we just can't tell you about it yet.
Trust
us, like just get your shit together, graduate and all that stuff, and then you'll get to see the cool stuff. And I'm like, okay. And like that was the thing fueling me. I didn't want to go back home to be another failure, because I'd failed at everything else that I've tried in life. And like this was more of an intellectual thing, and I'm more of an intellectual person than a physical person. So like this is my realm. I can fly through this, and I can prove all the doubters wrong who thought I was going to fail and all this stuff or have a mental breakdown. And so I had a mental breakdown. I remember going into the dining facility one day after trying so hard to keep it together. I even requested to see the chaplain again, but my platoon sergeant like just kept putting it off because we were like in the middle of some really intense studies, and I'd already like failed one of my tests. And if you fail again, then like you like have to get recycled. And then if you fail that, then they basically can say like, well, I know you signed up for military intelligence, but like you couldn't hack it. So guess what? You're now mortar men.
Oh no.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
God, it's like such high stakes, like literally like life or death. Like that is so intense.
Yeah, and I tried so hard. I didn't have anyone really to talk to. The one person that I felt like I can kind of talk to, I found in the dining facility that one evening with mm-hmm. about like 8 weeks left to go. And I told her, I sat down and said that I'm going to kill myself tonight. I want to die. And I froze, just like completely, like mouth agape. I had a catatonic episode. For those who don't know, it's basically, at least for me, is like a lot of people, they have like fight or flight responses. And I couldn't do that. I wasn't going to flee and go AWOL. Although like there were people that happened to, and have no idea what happened to them afterwards, and I couldn't fight anymore, and so I froze.
Right.
Couldn't fight or flight, so I froze. And I couldn't move, I couldn't talk, I can still hear things, but like, other than that, like I like literally had like saliva coming out of my mouth because
Wow.
I just like, there was just like the lights were on when no one was home. And mm-hmm. eventually, like, I had to be, like, picked up out of my seat and put on a stretcher and then taken to an ER. They have no idea what to do. And mm-hmm. I remember there was a guy in my basic training who had a similar thing where he went catatonic. And they actually, they took him up. They picked him up. They actually, like, put him on, like, in the back of a flatbed truck and took him to the emergency room. And he was, like, catatonic, like, to the point where they had to like put a catheter in him to check for drugs to see what was going on because they weren't sure what was going on with him. And I remember hearing about that and like thinking like, oh my God, that's like gotta be like the worst experience ever. And that's what they tried to do to me there. And thankfully I woke up before then.
Yeah.
Before that happened, but it was a very embarrassing experience. And I went back to my unit, walked into the building, to my barracks, just completely embarrassed. Didn't want anyone to see me, hoping that everyone would forget, that it would all blow over, and I'd get to finish my studies and become a military intelligence analyst, which is what I wanted to do with my Army career. Actually, that's not true. I actually wanted to do broadcasting.
Oh, that would have been a good fit.
Yeah, it wasn't available at the time, and I had to get the hell out of my house. It was a horrible living situation. And so I go to the on-post psychiatrist who says, we can give you another shot at trying to continue your being in the Army. But if this happens mm-hmm. again, then we have to send you to the psychiatric institution. I was like, no, like, and I remember one of the things she told, like, she asked me, like, so what do you want to do with your life? And, like, I was like, well, I still kind of want to become an actor, like, afterwards and be an entertainer, like, be, like do something public. And, like, she was, like, supportive of that. And, like, I was, like, actually, like really nice, like, because, like, I tell that to, like, the other soldiers and, like, drill sergeants and stuff, and they would laugh at me and think I was, like, gay or something. And so that was helpful. And so the following day... It happens again where I go catatonic. This time it's outside of my room. And so again, they have to pick me up and they take me to the post-psychiatrist who sees me again and tries to talk to me. And like, I don't want to talk at all. I'm not catatonic. I just don't want to talk about this because like I was just so embarrassed. Like I feel like I've really screwed up because like I know what's going to happen. And the psychiatrist says like, well, Mr. Caceres, this is a really good performance that you're putting on, but we're going to send you to the psych institution anyway.
No.
So yeah, so that's what happens. I go to the psych ward for, this is my first time ever in a psych ward. It's my first time like in a long time actually like being outside of that Army lifestyle.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, like, I go there. It's just, like, a completely foreign experience. There's some people who are, like, they're constantly in and out of psych ward. There was, like, one person, like, she was there because, like, her, like, husband, like, got, like, some court mandate. Like, she had to go to psych ward or else he would get to divorce her and take everything and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And this was a civilian psych ward. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There were other soldiers there.
Because it was so close to the base.
Yeah. Yeah. And so... At first I didn't want to do anything there. And then I realized, well, if I'm going to get out, I have to like play the game. I have to like, to like go to the group meetings and share my feelings mm-hmm. and like act quote unquote normal, take my meds and all that stuff. And so I got through that. I go back to my unit where I realize that I'm no longer in my unit. I have to go to like what they call like the hold platoon, where basically it's like a whole platoon basically for people who are either about to be recycled into another unit, just need some time before their next unit starts up, or they got hurt. There was like one guy, he got like in a skiing accident during winter break and like got completely paralyzed. And so like he basically just can do anything he wants, just walk anywhere. Well, that's not walk, but like use his walking like assistance thing.
Yeah.
And so I was in that platoon along with like people who had, like are like about to like go on to like other things or go home. And it was like six-ish week. No, it was like 8 weeks. And so I see people going one by one, and it feels like I'm going to be in this platoon forever. And like all we do is like sit around, or like we have to go to like the warehouse and clean cots or pick out weeds from the rocks. Because you always have to be doing something in the army. You can't just like, you can't just do nothing.
And like the furthest from like military intelligence, like how what you thought it would be like possible.
Especially at that point, like all bets are off as far as like ever like living that like military intelligence lifestyle. And so it finally becomes my time to go back home. And the day that I actually get discharged was the same day that I would have gone on to my next unit if I had stayed in the army. So as I'm like getting my stuff to go to the airport to go back home with nothing to show for it, people are there with their families. Like some people are going to Germany, others to South Korea. Some people are like are going to go back home, but then they're going to go to Afghanistan in 6 months. And yeah, it was just a really, really bad time in my life because like, again, I had failed. I go back home with like nothing to show for myself. I didn't tell anyone though that I had this diagnosis of at the time schizophrenia because of the catatonic episodes. I didn't tell anyone that. I just said like I had something and like and that was it. I was so embarrassed. I didn't want to talk about mental health. In my mind, I was going to find a way to go back into the army and right that wrong,
and then redo it.
Then day after day, week after week, month after month. That was obviously not going to happen. Like I wasn't like bathing most days. I wasn't like seeing friends because like I just felt so embarrassed. I had nothing going in my life. I tried going back into theater and then also tried to get like an associate's degree to something. Just try to get something going in my life.
Something, yeah.
For a while, I was kind of making it work. I was getting good-ish grades. I started doing some plays. I started getting back into my groove. But I also like had a situation where I was also very stressed out from all the stuff. As you would know, college life can be very hectic and very frustrating. And so, again, I had another catatonic episode, this time inside the theater as we're getting ready to rehearse for a play.
Oh, gosh.
And so I had to get put onto a stretcher and taken to the emergency room, and just the worst experience. I actually, like, I told the doctors that I didn't want to see anyone. And at first they're like, okay. Mm-hmm. And then like all of a sudden my mom came in and like doctors like, well, she wants to see you. She's your mom. So we're going to let her in. It was just such a violation of privacy. And like,
no one.
I said something. That's like, I'm catatonic. I said something. Like I said, no one.
Yeah. Respect that. Yeah.
Come on.
Like, yeah. And thankfully my director like was very understanding. I got to do the play and finish it. I was actually doing another play at the same time though. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back because then thankfully it was at home, but I had a friend who was going to come pick me up to go for a walk because she would help. She was very kind. She was very nice. And she would like say like if we go for a walk every week, then that'll help.
Yeah.
Get some positivity, get some exercise and everything. Cause I was also like gaining like a ton of weight and just completely
just depressed.
Oh yeah. Right? Just had like completely letting myself go. And she came one day and I wasn't answering the door, and because I was catatonic, I just had enough. And so she called my roommate, and the roommate came in, saw me, and then called 911 and had the paramedics or whoever come put me in to a stretcher, put me in restraints.
Oh, no.
Yeah, horrible experience, not very uncomfortable to say the least.
Yeah.
And then they take me to the emergency room again. And they're like, well, we need a urine sample from you, but we're not going to let you out of the restraints. And so even though like I was like totally cognizant. I was totally conscious, was able to talk, like wasn't catatonic at all. Like, I wasn't even catatonic like when the
paramedics came and everything.
So that was my where I finally had to have that experience of getting the catheter, and that definitely was the biggest invasion of my privacy that I've ever had. Yeah. Like, I see it as sexual abuse because it was like someone, mm-hmm. they were literally forcing themselves onto...
Non-consensually, yeah, inserting themselves inside of you.
Yeah, so like obviously ugh. Like they wouldn't categorize that. And like I've been told many, many times from many different people of all different perspectives that definitely not sexual abuse, but...
Well, it's... Great that they wanted to find that for you.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. If anyone besides medical professionals had done that, it would be sexual abuse. So, like, let's not, like, come on. Like, yeah. Come on.
Yeah. And this idea as well, it's like, well, he's acting kind of funny, so he must be on drugs. And, like,
right.
What would happen if they found drugs on me? Like, would they arrest me? Like, I was, like, in my own home. I don't know. It was a horrible experience. Yeah. And then I went to the psych ward again for another seven days.
There were such large failings that you had... no in-between treatment of like these four different like emergency room visits. Like, that's not your fault. Like, that's like their fault for not actually doing follow-up care. I mean, it's just whatever. I mean,
oh yeah, I mean the whole thing about the psych ward, at least for me, yeah. and like a lot of people that I talk to, it's more for to show that you're a good patient. Like, the only way to get out is to show that you're a good patient.
Take your meds every day, stop arguing, do the activities, even if the activities are like not available at the time. You just sit in the room and like tear out pieces of paper and hope that that proves it for them.
Yeah, because I would see like an actual therapist. Like, I think I maybe talked to a therapist twice while I was there, and then the rest is just like taking your meds and have someone walk around with a clipboard, just observing you, going to group therapy where like nobody wants to be there.
Yeah.
I remember we had like a movie night, and it was a movie about like the end of the world.
Yeah, that's so funny. When I was in the psych ward, it was like right after the like right when Trump was being inaugurated, and we weren't allowed to talk about it in group. Like, we couldn't, and we're like, well, that's all we're thinking about is like this person. And then the DVD player was broken, so they would just like play like the local news. It would be like school shooting, and we're just like it's like the worst place to like try and heal from something. Like, you're gonna try to like keep us here forever with this like shit.
Yeah, and then you're like sharing a room with a complete stranger who may or may not like want to kill you and all this stuff. And it's not the kind of place you go to heal.
No.
Like, I still, for the life of me, like, I hear about, like, some people where they go to these psych wards where, like, they have, like, iPads and Netflix and, like, there's, like, aquariums and paintings on the walls and stuff.
Yeah. What wards are those?
Where are they?
Like, please, like, drop a link. Like, make a list of them, because that's not the ones I found.
Yeah. So I finally got out of the psych ward with, like, nothing to show for myself. Like, I didn't even have shoes because they picked me up out of my bed. So I had to, like, get shoes that were too big for me from, like, the lost and found pile of the psych ward, and had to go walk to it. They actually, they gave me, like, bus tokens, but, like, they didn't give me enough for, like, the rail, which was, like, the station closest to me to get home. Because, like, I lived probably, like, 30 miles away from where the psych ward was.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, horrible experience. And but it was after that where, like, it was hitting rock bottom. And it's like, I need to do something with my life. And I don't want to hide from this. I don't want to be ashamed of it. And I pivoted from doing theater, and like, to the director's defense, like, if you have someone who's like can't do shows because they're like they're in the psych ward, and like you can't really rely on them because you never know when they're gonna have a complete breakdown and you have to recast in the middle of nowhere, so that kind of ended my my acting career, at least for the time being. And so I wanted to do public speaking, because there it's like me sharing my story, and it's I get to be at the forefront. Like, before, like I would just be like guy number four or dude who comes in at the end anyway. So like, I always felt unsatisfied with that. I always wanted to be like on a stage. I wanted to like to put on a show and to really like do something with my life and be a public figure. And so I was seeing a therapist on campus, and thankfully our campus, like, you can go see someone for free every single week. And my therapist, we instantly hit it off. She was really cool. She was only a few years older than me. Like, we totally got each other, but she really challenged me, and she wanted me to like stop making excuses or like stop worrying about all these things that I think I should be doing. Like, I was 26 at the time. Like, I thought, like, I should be, like, already have my master's. Like, I was comparing myself to friends from high school who had already were married and had one or two kids already, careers, all that stuff. And so one of the things that helped me was that she had started this chapter of Active Minds on campus. For those who don't know about Active Minds, it's a national nonprofit that was created by this person named Allison Malman, whose brother died by suicide. And she was really affected by that and wanted to create a nonprofit in his honor that existed on college campuses that got people to talk about mental health and to normalize getting help, making sure all the students knew about the resources. And so that's what we were doing. And I started sharing my story for the first time. I was actually the club president, and I had never been president of anything before. And I sucked as president. I couldn't do anything. Like, we tried to do like a bake sale, and like I put on all the responsibility on everyone else, and it was a bad experience. But I at least ripped off that band-aid of starting to share my story. Right. And I was even posting about it on Facebook, so people knew about it who like never knew about my story. So I wanted to continue doing it. And so like the following semester, I continued Active Minds as president, and I wanted to get this grant from the state. It was like a big deal. It was like $10,000, but like you had to like write a grant proposal that was like, you had to like do all these essays and stuff like this. I was working on it so hard. It was like, I've never worked on something so hard in my life. I'm used to like always like slacking and never doing my homework and all that stuff, but I wanted to get this thing. And it was like the last day before the deadline. And I decided to go to a cafe that I like to frequent and like just knock everything out. But I forgot that I had taken my medication. And the medication, like if you don't take it, I can't even remember the name of it, but like whatever. It has a very bad withdrawal effect. Very bad. Oh, like you get the brain zaps and all that stuff. And so that's what was happening to me. And I actually like even like drove to the beach and then drove back to complete this thing. And when I had finished, I went to the barista, who was a really cool guy, and told them that I don't really feel well. Like, I feel really weird and all this stuff. And, like, I just need to talk to someone. And so, and so thankfully, like, he got someone to cover for him. And we're walking in, like, in the parking lot. And he's just trying to talk me through this because I think that I'm going to have a catatonic episode. That it's going to happen again. I'm not going to get the grant, and I'm going to be a failure again. And he talked me out of it. I was calm. I got my medication, and I felt like I had like kicked this thing's ass. That I am.
You beat it.
I defeated it. I just like I felt like I was like on cloud nine. That like I can do anything now. Like I defeated mental illness. I am the man.
Where's my grant? Because I just figured out how to defeat.
I will take my award now.
Yeah. I didn't get the grant, by the way. just like
sometimes
totally.
It's about the journey.
Yeah, I know. Like, yeah, like all the grant awardees were like organizations and stuff, and I was like just some guy, like just total. But I didn't care because, like, in my mind, like I can do anything now. And so like I was going into club meetings and saying like, yeah, we're going to do this and that. And like I was even like going to like student government meetings and making demands. I told them that I wanted my own parking spot because like I was like constantly like being late for my meetings and stuff. And like I told someone that like I need to have like my own like Wi-Fi set up like on campus, so like when I walk on campus with my phone, it automatically connects to its own Wi-Fi, because like I hated putting in my password every single time I would want to log into the school Wi-Fi. Like I got really mad.
And you had defeated Dulles.
I got really mad at everyone because like I felt like people were trying to like treat me like a kid. Like I said, like I was like 26 and like they wouldn't even like let me use one of the computers for the room where we had our meetings at for the Active Minds. You had to have like a teacher like in the same room, like like I guess I like thought like I was like a look at porn or something. And so I just felt like really so offended. Weird. And just constantly like feeling like people were trying to box me in. And like one day as I'm going to school, I'm thinking like, this kind of sounds like a little manic-y.
Yep.
That was what I was thinking.
We were like, what is that?
And like, and mind you, like, oh, bipolar. I never thought about a bipolar diagnosis.
I knew very
little about it. And in my mind, like, I wasn't anything now. I wasn't depressed anymore. No. I didn't have anxiety.
You were no longer mentally ill.
I was like totally not even thanking people who who had left the door open for me when I was walking into buildings. Like, I was that kind of asshole.
You're like, you're welcome for walking through. What are you talking about?
Yeah, like I wasn't even coming to classes anymore. And then like I remember I had a teacher who tried to kick me out of the class. And I'm like, I could come for the final and like ace the final. Like, why do you care?
Yeah. Like kicking me out of the class, I should be teaching this. What are you talking about?
Yeah, like, and I was actually like, it was like the same teacher. Like I had said, like I can like give a presentation to the class because it was a psychology class about like what a successful like crazy person looks like.
Oh my gosh!
And all this stuff.
This is like type like
I know
which I did actually I. Like, great. I would go to the nursing office. I would go to other classrooms and say, like, hey, can I give, like, I would even go to, like, the VA hospital in Long Beach and, like, find people. Like, hey, like, can I give a speech for you guys? Like, just, like, anytime, like, you want, like, a public speaker? Like, I would walk in there with, like, my shorts and sandals.
And they're like, please leave.
Yeah.
But they probably weren't, though, right? They were just like,
Well, the VA.
He seems very confident.
Yeah, the VA. VA no. Really they were like, we only want, like, doctors to present. Like, we don't even know you. Like, but on campus, they were like, sure, like, how much time do you need? And I was like, oh, I can, like, 10 minutes is good. I'm like, okay, like, we'll give you 30. So, like, that's, like, how a lot of my early public speaking was. Like, I would just, like go to people and like or classrooms and like even outside of my own college and be like, hey, like, you want like a public speaker? and that's how it started. But like I was,
you're like, suddenly I have high self-esteem. I don't know, it's definitely because of this one incident, not because of anything else. So here you go.
Oh yeah, like I would even go to like the cafe and stay there all day, like hours, because I didn't want to go home, because like there I felt like a little kid still, because I was like living with family and like they didn't understand how great I was. And like I was actually still ashamed to talk to like my immediate family about it. If they saw my Facebook post, that's whatever. But because like it runs in my family, and it's weird because like they acknowledge it runs in the family, but they think it's all like bullshit and like all that stuff.
Real.
Yeah,
right, sure.
Just
yeah.
like be a man, all that stuff.
Just like a certain darkness that passes through. Yeah.
Yeah. So we finally get to the end of the semester. They actually like the club, and they throw like a surprise like party for me, and like to thank me. Because like even though like I was like an asshole, like I actually like did a lot for the group.
Yeah.
And yeah. Like after everyone left, my advisor talks to me, who's a faculty member, and she's like, it's great that you're doing all this like mental health stuff, Rudy, but you're a smart guy, like you need to like focus, maybe like you can like go on to a 4-year university, you can be like an accountant, you can be like a lawyer or something like that, and like and treat this like mental health thing as like a hobby. That's what it is. Like, you need to get a real job.
And you're like, how
do you? Yeah, I'm like arguing with her, and like I'm just like actually I remember like someone like even like looked into like the room that we were talking into, because it was like that heated, because like it was like really intense, because like I did not want to hear that, because
of course,
like, yeah, because like it was again, like people are trying to like box me in, people are trying to define me, people are trying to say I'm sick, that I'm manic, and all this stuff. In my mind, they're sick.
Yeah, yeah,
because they don't understand that I have achieved something greater than all of them. I defeated depression, defeated anxiety. I know all the keys to success. Like I would actually like call like random like business owners and property owners and say like, I have this great idea for a business, and just like constantly finding ways to like push myself forward and do all these things. Like I felt like I was like in the minor league, still going to community college. And so we kept going back and forth, and eventually I just conceded and said to her that, like, you know what? You're right. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. What's the end game with this mental health thing? This is not a career. This is like with going to classrooms and like telling your story. And like, that's not a job. That's going to get me like blackballed, and like where I'm not going to be able to have like real careers, because that's going to be the first thing people see when they Google me.
Right.
And that day was the first time I had been depressed since like I had that initial manic spark.
Oh, no.
So this is like, I had that brush with catatonia like at the end of October, and this was in like mid-December. So that whole time.
Oh, okay, quick. Yeah.
That, you think that was quick, then I have other stories.
No, sorry. It's just like the abruptness from like being manic to depressed is so quick. Like it happens like you're never expecting it.
Yeah. Like I thought I would never be depressed again because I had like. Because
you were a god.
Yeah. I had the secrets. For me,
yeah.
Bipolar was about the poles. It was about depressed and mania and trying to find a balance with that. For me, I was depressed almost my entire life because I always felt like I could never be the person that I wanted to be. I always felt embarrassed to even talk about my dreams and my goals. And I finally broke out of that and wanted to realize my potential. And that's where the mania hit, where there was no stopping me. There was no filter. Like I was like just also like spending all my money. I was like trying to get like loans. Like I remember the bank that I was talking to. They're saying like, well, we actually just like run this through a computer and the computer decides. And I was like, no, like they're gonna deny me. Just like let me convince you that I'm good for the money.
Like I know it's how it works for other people, but again, I am not other people.
Yeah, I thought like I could talk anyone into anything.
Yeah.
So for me, it was like constantly going like from. Depression being like I couldn't be who I want to be, and then mania like going like an overdrive on that, and then just having like no sense of balance, no sense of is this right or wrong. It's more about just like I want to do this thing, and anyone who tries to stop me, they're the sick ones.
Yep.
And so yeah, and then the depression hit, and that was a really, really deep depression that took many years to get out of. But even with the depression, like I still wanted to keep sharing my story. So I got involved with the National Alliance of Mental Illness and started sharing my story for them. Like they would send me anywhere. I was like the guy who'd be like, yes to everything. I'd go inside of a psych ward where people were not even listening to me. People were like there'd be like guys who were like trying to like touch me and grab me or like take their clothes off. I actually had a speaking partner once because we'd go there in duos who actually had trained me initially, who was in turn manic herself and started swearing at people and all this stuff. Like I've gone to juvenile halls where they're not allowed to talk or like react at all. So it's like, it was my biggest audience to that point. I spoke in front of like 700 teenagers. And none of them like reacted at all.
Because they're not allowed to do anything. They're like,
yeah. And I'm like, I'm gonna lighten the mood. I'm gonna try to tell some jokes. And it's just like nothing. Just
like a bunch of teens sitting there judging me silently.
Like, yeah. And so like yeah. And like so I've spoken in front of high schools, junior highs. Junior high is awesome because like they think it's all about them. They're the biggest jerks in the world. They don't. And like I actually won them over. It was so funny because like I went there with a parent, and they treated the parent like garbage. Like where the parent almost gave up, and she was like, okay, well, like there you go, Rudy. And so I go on there, and there's kids talking on their phones. This is like 2018, I think. No one, like there are people, like the girls are doing each other's hair and makeup, and the guys are like talking about like all kinds of other things. And so like I felt like I really like won them over. I was like, yeah. And so like for a while I was like just like doing that, and like then I hit a brick wall, and where it's like I wanted to keep doing more and more and more, and I got connected with this person named Amy Bruhl, who created this nonprofit called Project Semicolon. If anyone's ever seen the tattoos, the semicolon tattoo, it comes partly from that. And so she was like, my original speaking partner had to like cancel at the last minute. Like, do you want to come to Quincy, Illinois with me to do some presentations? Because it was Suicide Prevention Month, and they actually had a string of suicides in the high school for students.
Oh, gosh.
So they wanted to have a whole week of events with speakers and education and stuff like that. And so I went to Quincy, Illinois, which I've never been to. It's like 2 hours outside. It's like one of those Mayberry type towns, like nothing like mm-hmm. at all going for it. You can walk from one end of town to the other. It's actually, it was weird because to get there, we had to go to St. Louis first. And so like I went to the same airport that I went to when I was in the Army.
Yeah.
So that was a trip. Actually get to see St. Louis and not just like go on a bus from like the airport to the to the woods.
Basic training.
Yeah. And it's like I felt like this is my big break and like I'm telling my story, I'm doing a good job and all this stuff. And at the end of the trip, Amy had said that, to be honest, you're not what I was expecting. You got a long way to go to be a speaker. You got to change this and that. Other people that I brought with me, like people wanted to talk to them afterwards and like get their information. And I didn't see any of that. And like you would take up too much of the question and answer time. And people really just wanted to hear me speak. So yeah, that was a real deflating moment. But like, in my mind, I was like, I'm going to prove her wrong and
right.
I'm going to go like just twice as hard. And I mean, I guess the silver lining out of that is like I got more speaking work because people took me more seriously. And so I got to mm-hmm. speak at the Disneyland Hotel at a Kaiser Permanente conference. That was fun. They got to wine and dine me and all that fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Got to speak in front of like 700 like healthcare professionals, and it got recorded professionally mm-hmm. and all that stuff. I got to speak at the Sacramento Capitol at an event that was headlined by the actor Richard Dreyfuss. I got to meet all kinds of cool people and like go to events with celebrities and travel, which I'd never done before up until like very recently. And it was just like the whole world was opening before me. And it was because mm-hmm. of mental health. It was because I was sharing my story. It was because I was bipolar. If I wasn't, like, I might have, like, still have been trying to chase some theater or acting dream and, like, be, like, one of my friends from community college who's, like, acting underneath Chinese restaurants for, like, $0 and in front of, like, 10 people. So it's weird how that works out, because it's, like, mm-hmm. I'm not thankful that I was hospitalized. Like, I'm actually, like, still, like, very anti-force treatment and just, like, wish that no one had to... was ever forcibly hospitalized. Like, I'm not thankful for my breakdowns and like having to go through these traumatic experiences, these stops and goes with all mm-hmm. kinds of different medications and therapies, not being able to be in a relationship for the longest time because I didn't think I was worthy of being loved. Thankfully, I'm happily married now and doing a lot better in life.
Congratulations.
But yeah, because of bipolar, all of this happens and I get to be on your podcast. And I have a feeling that if I wasn't bipolar, I probably wouldn't be on this podcast.
You need to have something going on up there to get on.
Bipolar, OCD. Schizophrenia would have been cool if that was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like now I feel like I'm still... like I'm in a state of transition because of COVID, and it's not mm-hmm. like I can go on stage anymore, and like even doing the live streaming stuff, that's all fun, but I still feel like something is missing. And mm-hmm. I think this happens with a lot of different mental health advocates where you put yourself out there and you share your mm-hmm. story, you talk about all the things that like people that like who aren't mental health advocates are too afraid to talk about. And so they thank you and mm-hmm. they're glad that someone is sharing their story and telling the world like how being bipolar really is. And now it's like, well, I don't want to just be the bipolar guy. I don't want to just like just talk about bipolar.
Right.
But it's like, this is like what I'm known for. Like, should I just accept mm-hmm. that fate, or should I try to challenge myself? Like, what do I do next?
Yeah.
What is next for you? And also, has Amy ever apologized, or have you spoken with her since then?
Well, I should have mentioned this before. To be serious, like Amy was going through a bad place at that time, and she went to this retreat soon afterwards to help out. She was going through really bad depression. She was still actively suicidal and just going through a very hard time. And then she got back and was eventually diagnosed with bipolar and didn't have anyone to talk to.
Aww.
and had reached out to me out of the blue early the following year and just like saying like, I just want to pick your brain about bipolar and talk to you because like, I don't have anyone else to talk to and things are going like sour with family. And so it was good to have that connection and to kind of like patch things up to make sure that we're on good terms, because a month later I found out that she had died by suicide.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, and no one else but her family knew about it for a while, and I had posted about it on social media, and then everyone like started posting about it like on the news and stuff, and it was a big story, and it was just very hard for a lot of people because you get this tattoo to to signify that your life didn't end and period. It kept on going with a semicolon. And when I would talk to Amy, she would remark about how the only reason I don't want to kill myself is because I don't want to let all these people down.
Yeah.
And when I talked to her the last time, she had mentioned how like, I finally feel like I'm at a place where the semicolon project is much bigger than myself.
Bigger than her.
Yeah. And I think that was part of the closure that she needed to, in her mind, justify taking her life.
Yeah.
It was a very sad time and it was very weird because like part of me was like, we had the, we were on bad terms. It was weird to kind of like reconcile that. And thankfully we were at least able to talk and to patch things up. But it was, I always think about that, about how she didn't want to die because she didn't want to let these people down because they all looked up to her and that the movement was about her. And then when she had in her mind concluded that it wasn't about her, and that's all she needed to take her life and move on. So it's just interesting how that works out. And she would always tell me like, just be ready for when media hits and the press and people come after you and everyone wants a piece of you and all that stuff and tries to say bad things about you in the media and interviews and like people you thought you were friends. And so it was a really interesting relationship with her because she taught me a lot of important things.
Right.
So it's just sad how it turned out because she really meant a lot to a lot of different people.
Right. It's, yeah, I mean, in the mental illness, like, advocacy space, I'm sure there's a lot of stories like that that you're hearing. And also, it's just, like, you know, as much as we wish it was, like, something that, like you said, that you could overcome by, like, just getting out of that catatonic state that one time, unfortunately, it's just not that simple. And I think so many of us, especially with bipolar, there's so much self-blame that comes with it, and there's so much stigma that comes with it. So you're not able to really get the help until it's very, very late in the game.
Yeah.
And also, unfortunately, we know the efficacy rates for death by suicide are just higher when you're bipolar, unfortunately.
Yeah, and one of the things that her story demonstrates is that it's very hard. Like, when you're a mental health advocate, the pressure to be, like, a good quote-unquote mental health advocate or a good patient is very strong.
Right.
Because when you base your career about like saying like, oh, it gets better and like it's like you anyone can recover and like use these tools and all this stuff and like reach out for help if you need it. And so when the time comes, and it comes for everyone, where you are in a situation where you need help, when you're at your worst, the voices come back, the mania comes back, the suicidal depression comes back, the panic attacks come back.
Right.
It's very hard to, it's very easy to get in your mind about how like, oh, well, I failed because like, if I was a good mental health advocate, like, and then I would use these tools that I advocate for and all this stuff. So one of the things that I learned from that experience is that we need to normalize as mental health advocates that we all, no matter we can have a good stretch for years and years and years. It's totally fine if we have a breakdown. It's totally fine if we just have like a complete crash, or if we suddenly start hearing voices or start seeing things again or all this stuff. Right. And it's hard. It's still hard because you still feel like you're going against the grain, or at least that's how I feel. Like, it's, because like I've had friends who are are public speakers and make a lot of money, and they have public breakdowns, and they get contracts canceled, they get opportunities canceled, and people unfollow them, they get hate messages and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's hard because people want to see, they want to see you succeed, they want to see you come up, they want that rags to riches story. But the minute you start slipping, that's when I totally knew that was going to happen. I totally knew they couldn't handle the pressure, or they were lying. Right. They were always depressed. They were never happy. They were just bullshitting all this stuff. So
yeah,
it's tough.
It's such a shame, because like that's the thing that prevents people then from reaching out to actually get help if they need it too. So, I mean, I think that your work does a really good job with normalizing that it's not just like, oh, once you get your diagnosis, then it's like, oh, okay, like everything's good after that. Like all you need to do is go into the hospital for like a week, and then like, you know. And I think a lot of times like these stories are so much more complicated than that. And like, congratulations to whoever it is who, you know, has one manic episode, one depressive episode, and then never has it again. I, like, for myself and Maria, we're pretty early in our journeys, and hopefully that is how it stays. But I, like, we are very prepared, like, very prepared for when that isn't the case, and it'll be awkward to put this podcast on hiatus or whatever.
Yeah, nobody be mean to us if I become hypomanic.
One of the worst things for your mental health is to be a public mental health advocate.
Like, also it's so necessary too, so like what do you do with that, right?
Yeah, like I see it a lot of peers, a lot of people I started out with, like around the same time, sharing our stories online. It eventually happens to all of us, where we hit that brick wall, or we have that traumatic event in our family, or past trauma is reawakened, or medication stopped working, your therapist quits, or you have like all kinds of different things, and you just can't put up a front anymore. Not saying that like we're like always putting up a front, like obviously like like people can get well and people can succeed and all that stuff, but it's so hard, it's weird, because like me and a lot of others I talk to, you feel like you have to be like twice or three times as happy as a regular person who is like recovering from like mental health issues would be.
Right.
Like most people who are like doing quote unquote well after a break are relatively unremarkable. Whereas with people like who identify as mental health advocates and public figures and social media influencers, that's not enough. Like we also have to like go on public speaking tours. We have to write books. We have to do like YouTube videos and documentaries and podcasts and all these things. Yeah. So we're making it even harder for us. We could easier be in a place of contentment, but a lot of times we're not okay with that. We have to keep pushing ourselves. We have to get more followers. We have to do a bigger venue to speak in front of. Mm-hmm. We have to have more YouTube subscribers or Twitch followers or what have you. So it's weird because we're doing it for a good reason, to spread mental health awareness, to end a stigma and all that stuff, and get people to normalize talking about mental health. And it's like one of like the worst things you can do for your mental health.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, we're like 1 year into like having this podcast and stuff like that, but I will say it's like the thing that I've like stayed up the latest for this past year, like editing the podcast, or like it is like a pressure to, I don't know, like just keep it up, because like it does help people, and like we know that it does because people tell us, which isn't like obviously like the reason we're doing it, but it's also like a thing that we're doing like on top of our full-time jobs that like probably our therapist wouldn't be like, yeah, and so what I want you to do for your mental health is want you to start doing this thing that takes like 10 hours a week that you're not getting like paid for, really, besides thank you to our Patreon subscribers. But like, I mean, I want to do it, but you also feel like you have to do it because like bipolar disorder specifically is like so stigmatized, and nobody like besides mental health advocates is talking about it. Like you kind of have to either be like a professional bipolar person who's like fully out with it, or like feel like you have to be like completely like private, like, about it in order to be like quote unquote normal.
It's a weird setup we have, but the thing about being a creative as well is that, especially for me, I'm trying to do a much better job of not like making declarative statements like on behalf of everyone. For me, I can't just do nothing. Some people like they just want the security. They don't want to have to worry about money. They want a house over their head and be able to eat a good meal every night. Whereas me and a lot of other creatives, that's not enough. We can have a lot of money, but if we're not creatively fulfilled, that's could be a source for depression, to feel like there's a void not being filled. But if I push myself, if I'm working on a project, when I was doing a podcast last year, it was some of the most anxiety that I've had in a very long time, because it is a lot of work. It's very tedious. Like the actual recording part is as fun as it gets. Everything else after that is just like maddening.
Right.
Especially as a beginner, where I'd done nothing. I had like no podcast editing experience. Like I learned like everything on the job. And so it's just like stuff that would take like a pro like an hour is taking me like 10 hours.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so, but like I love that creative output. I love putting it out there into the world and having people listen to it and like seeing the fruits of the labor. But there's so much about it. Like even something like public speaking, there's like so many things that are just frustrating and annoying about public speaking, right, which like you think is like so easy. You go on stage and start talking and all that stuff, and as long as you don't have like stage fright or whatever.
Yeah, isn't most people's like greatest fear public speaking?
That's so weird. Yeah, I don't get that at all. Like I would get that like if you have like no experience and like someone like thrust you on stage. Like I totally understand that. But the most frustrating things about public speaking are things where it's like I'm already late and I can't find the parking lot, or
and no one gave you the parking space. Yeah, you need the parking space.
And the Wi-Fi password. Can anyone get Rudy a parking space?
Yeah,
please?
Yeah. Or like I want to play a video on their projector and like their cable doesn't work or something like that or all that stuff.
Right.
I know, total first, like for me, first person problems and all that stuff.
But no, it's your job.
It's your job.
That's important. Job.
Yeah. Or going to speak in front of like a bunch of like doctors and like half of them are like on their cell phones and like walking out and stuff and like, it's like not even silencing their phones. Like I've had like doctors like talk on their phone like in front of me as I'm sharing my story.
Oh, God. Right, we're not anti-doctor on this podcast, but
we're not like
the amount of times that like we have been like ignored by psychiatrists, for example, or like brushed over. I'm sure in the hospital was not your most like listened to point of time, was like talking to your psychiatrist. Yeah. So
anybody who's that too, that they much can be education rude too.
yeah so yeah. But I, all in all, like I'm still like I'm only 33, so like I'm kind of like going through that whole quarter life crisis where it's just like I don't know how old all of you are, but around this age, like late 20s, early 30s, like once starts to feel like, wait, I'm no longer young. And like I thought it was bullshit when people would say this, like when I was a kid. There will be a time, right, and some people it happens sooner than others. There will be a time where you have like an epiphany where it's like, wait, things that are popular in mainstream right now, I don't get.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. That's Fast and Furious.
Yeah, like that. That's how I am with TikTok, where it's like,
oh yeah, well, we don't.
I don't get it, but everyone else does, or at least like young people do, and like some cool old people. So this means I'm old now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you lose not that we lost the year of your life, but you go from being, 32 a year ago to 33 now, and nothing happened for a year. A lot happened, but nothing.
Yeah.
All your hot years.
You moved to Colorado, but.
You moved to Colorado, but yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
You
get to that stage where it's like, wait, am I 33 or am I 32?
It took me like 5 minutes to think of it. I was like, I think I'm 27. Now I'm like, nope.
We're 26. We're still 26.
Yeah.
The same age Rudy was when he was a king.
Yeah. So it's only going to go uphill from where you are. Like I did have a podcast when I was 26, and that was even worse.
Oh my God, wait, where can we...
If we could find that and put people to it.
No. I think it might be on my SoundCloud still, but like I haven't updated it in forever.
I keep this to play for like psychiatric histories only, and then...
It's so bad. It's so bad because it's just like me... it's me and a friend from high school who like we would just like talk forever. We would talk for hours and we'd say, hey, we should record this. And so like we were looking for a space, and then I reconnected with another friend from high school who had like an auto dealership, and it's like, hey, you can record in my office, but like I want to be on the podcast. And like so we'd go to his office like after his work was over and crowd around like one microphone that I bought on Amazon. And to show you how badly it went, I was able to return the podcast microphone to Amazon within the return window, and then I ended up in the psych ward like a week after the fact. No. I probably should have mentioned that
the
was also
that the presence
was also a factor.
Yeah, to be fair,
I definitely attempted to bully my friends into starting a podcast when I was manic as well. And we also recorded around one microphone, like on their bed, and like kind of took turns talking. Like,
maybe we don't do anything with this for a little while. Perhaps we just keep...
Yeah.
Okay.
I probably did like 5 or 6 episodes, and the last episode actually is where it's really sad. I think it's like the 7th episode where I'm basically like, I have like nothing going on. Like I just feel like a loser and all this stuff. I was like so depressed, like so sad, and it's like
this is good content. This is good.
I know. It was like when I first started, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do a podcast, it's gonna be fun, and like we're gonna like
within like a 7-day period
everyone's gonna find us so interesting and all this stuff. Like I even had a friend who was like a music producer to like make an original song for like her intro song and all this stuff.
Oh cool.
I know. Cool. Horrible podcast. and yet like I ended up doing another one like 10 years later.
Yeah,
there you go. And okay, so it has been so lovely talking with you. You are a very good storyteller, which I feel like you already know, but I'm just going to reiterate that was the most engaging like diagnosis story I've ever heard. I was like on pins and needles the entire time, and I knew most of it already, which was like very, very...
You couldn't see Anna and I, but we kept going like covering our mouths and being like, what next?
Like wide eyes. The widest my eyes have been in months. So thank you so much. And on that note, so you are still doing advocacy, you're no longer doing that podcast, but what else are you doing? Where else can people find you, and anything else that you'd like to plug?
Well, you know, I actually am proud of my last podcast that I did, so go check that out. It's called the Open Excellence Podcast. It was actually the same name of the nonprofit that I was working for. Their previous podcast host left, and so they were like, hey, like, you want to do it? And I'm like, yes.
Yes,
a microphone.
I know.
I guess.
So like, I totally went all out this time. Like, I actually got like a decent microphone. Like, got like soundproof padding and all this stuff, and like got to interview some really cool people. So go check that out. Like, there's only 4 episodes but I did everything. I booked the guests. I developed the format, the topic. I edited it from scratch with like no experience at all. mixed it and like did all the sound equalization and all that stuff and put it all together. Took like hours of audio footage and put it down into like hour-long episodes. So please go check that out, because
I am so excited too.
A 4-part series.
Yeah. So I was really proud of that. So go check out Open Excellence Podcast, hosted by Rudy Caceres, wherever you listen to Bipolar by Coastal.
Yep, we're on everything. So
yeah.
He is too.
But other than that, like, yeah, I'm still doing the monthly Facebook Lives for The Mighty. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually doing one. I don't know when this comes out. So my March episode will be on Bipolar, living with bipolar, but also running a nonprofit. So I have 3 people on who worked at nonprofits and started their own. So that'll be cool because like it's not as easy as it sounds.
No. It turns out a lot of things are harder when you're living with bipolar disorder.
Yeah. I'm always blown away by people who can ride that wave of bipolar, but also like do things like run a nonprofit. I always try to like either do things on my own or with a very tight group, because like I can't do like the whole like working with a board and all that stuff and like having people vote and stuff.
Yeah.
But go check that out. Actually, If you go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/RudyCaceres, you can see all of my past episodes. That way you don't have to log into Facebook and like get sucked down that black hole. You can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Rudy Caceres. And you can also still follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/RudyCaceres, and go to my website, rudycaceres.com, and there's a contact sheet on there if you want to email me and work together. I think you contacted me through Instagram.
I found Instagram.
DM me, email me, Facebook message. It's all good. I love it when people reach out to me out of the blue, because I did not know you, either of you, at all.
Mm-mm.
And we connected.
So we're
doing a podcast together, and hopefully this is not the last time. So that could be you too.
Oh, hopefully not.
Oh my yes. God.
And if you have an auditorium full of 700 junior high schoolers for Rudy to talk to, he kills. So
yeah,
he crushes with that.
If you
audience.
Ever need middle someone to talk to middle schoolers, reach out to Rudy. He's got you.
Yes, I will put them in their place.
Yes, they'll pay attention.
Yeah. Oh man, that feels like so far away. But yeah, I really do hope I can get to a place of public speaking again.
Everyone else is like, man, I want to go out to the clubs again. And Rudy's like, I need an auditorium. When can the vaccine happen soon enough that I can go to an auditorium?
Yeah, I can like go speak on an island or something. It's whatever. Like I just got to get back into the game.
AKA what a podcast is. Just speaking on an island. Speaking in your closet to yourself.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much again, Rudy.
Yeah.
This is so fun. And enjoy, everyone. Yeah.
Definitely not the last time we'll be talking to Rudy.
And stay bipolar.
Stay bipolar. Because you can't help it. It's time for life.
Might as well accept it.
And stay bi-coastal.
Bye.
Bye. If you liked what you heard and want more, you can get at least 2 bonus episodes every month for just $5 by subscribing to our Patreon, patreon.com/bipolarbicoastal. Or you can email us any questions, comments, or concerns you might have at bipolarbicoastal@gmail.com.
Your emails are truly the highlight of our week. You can find us at facebook.com/bipolarbicoastal or on Instagram at bipolarbicoastal. Thank you to Mia Thoreau, who did our show art, Hannah Dorfman, who does our music, and Evie Davis, who did our portraits. Goodbye!
Goodbye!